Blog Talk Radio.
In Dallas, Texas, on Sunday, March the 17th. Happy St. Patrick's Day to everyone out there. Today, as we like to do on Sundays, we'll be chatting with our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Lots to get into this week, as always. Beto is in, and Mr. Biden may be in, too, or at least he said he was in, and then he said, no, I'm not really in. But anyway, interesting week for the Democrats. Also, Rahm Emanuel, the outgoing mayor of Chicago, has a message for the Democrats. We'll get into that. Mr. Trump had to veto legislation for the first time this week. It has to do with that emergency on the border. There are more Trump investigations in New York. Not exactly sure what, but it's happening up there. Jeb Bush made a statement. He would like to see a Republican run in 2020 against President Trump. So lots to get into today with our friend Bill Katz. How are you, Bill? Happy St. Patrick's Day to you.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I'm not a member of that tribe, but St. Patrick's Day is always a spirited day here in New York, as we have so many people of Irish descent. And
sure.
I think that the parade, for some reason, was held yesterday, and I don't know what the reason for it was. But St. Patrick's Day, always important. They usually paint a green stripe down the avenue where the parade is held.
I see. And, you know, I was reading, Bill, the first parade was in 1762. That surprised me a little bit. I didn't think it went back that far. I thought it was more of a 19th century thing.
I'm surprised, too. Most of the large Irish immigration occurred in the 19th century, as you kind of implied. I'm very surprised it went back that far.
Yeah, I guess I was too, and I double-checked the date, and yes, it was. I always thought it was more like in the second half of the 19th century, as you had the Irish immigrations coming into New York primarily. Bill, before we get to the topics, I just wanted to bring this up because I find it atrocious that they are now blaming President Trump for what happened in New Zealand. I mean, look, our prayers, our thoughts are with those families. That was a terrible thing to happen. Absolutely horrible what happened in New Zealand. But immediately they're blaming President Trump, and I don't get that, Bill.
Well, the standards are so low today for blaming people that, yes, you hear them saying that, well, he set a tone. He set a tone. And, you know, one of the things that really angers me is that he didn't set a tone. He never encouraged anybody to do anything like this. He did, in fact, and definitely has condemned Islamic terrorism. I mean, but he has never condemned the Islamic religion. He's never done anything to insult the Islamic religion. He has a very good relationship with Muslim countries in the Middle East. He was invited to Saudi Arabia, and there was a large conference of Muslim nations with him addressing it. You know, it's reaching the level now where anything goes, and I'm afraid people have gotten used to it, although I really, because I think most voters discount that. But
I think so. Not only the voters, Bill, but the television viewers. I mean,
yes.
CNN was where they were peddling this on CNN, and I just saw some ratings for CNN. I mean, they're down to, well, a million people is a lot of people. I mean, I'm not discounting that. But compared to the others, that's not a lot of people. And they're losing large audiences, and I think a lot of it has to do with this kind of garbage. I mean, when they've got people on their network saying stuff like this, I mean, I couldn't put up with it. I shut it off, Bill.
Well, I don't blame you for shutting it off. And when you realize that in a country of 330 million people, a million viewers is, that's fewer than one-third of 1% of mm-hmm. the American public. The reason CNN has influence is that it's influential in Washington. You know, mm-hmm. the Washington political community watches it, and the elites watch it. But other than that, I don't know of anybody who I've very rarely heard anyone outside those groups actually comment on something that was on CNN. But you're right. I heard the morning broadcast after this terrible tragedy, and there was Allison Camerota and her sidekick, mm-hmm. whose name I can never remember, kind of nodding at this. Well, you know, I mean, he made it possible. No, he didn't make it possible. This individual was obviously deranged, had a point of view. Now, of course, immediately we're told that he's a white supremacist. He sees this.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, among other crazy things he said in his manifesto was that his ideal model for a country was was communist China. But for some reason, that page fell out in a lot of the reporting. You get a deranged person like that, they often, this is not uncommon, when they often say, "I was inspired by," and people immediately put the two names together. That's something you have to be very careful about, because he's obviously not a normal person.
Right, and who, I mean, who would walk into anything and start shooting people? Obviously not a normal person. But it upsets me because I guess a lot of people believe it. It's not just CNN. I mean, there's people who actually believe this. And I'm just sitting there, did anybody say that, you know, when you had that incident in Orlando where the guy walked in and started, the Muslim guy walked in and started to shoot everybody at that gay bar or whatever. Did anybody say that Obama's drones inspired that? I don't remember.
Right.
And yet, you know, Obama was dropping a lot of drones and killing a lot of people in that part of the world. Did anybody suggest it?
Yes. Obama got away with everything, absolutely everything. And if there is a member of a minority group or a traditionally disenfranchised group, as they say, on the Democratic ticket next year, there's no question that that person will also get away with it. And it's unfair to that group, it's demeaning to that group, and it's unfair to the country. There was a meeting this week, according to the press, between Joe Biden, who I think is almost certain to run
mm-hmm.
At this point, and Stacey Abrams, who was the defeated Democratic candidate for governor of Georgia. Now, I don't know what this was about, but she's been talking about making a national race, and maybe he will make her vice presidential candidate, which will be a very awkward situation because she has no actual experience, you know, for that role, but she is a member of minority, and as a result, will probably get away, will be given a pass. And the vice presidential candidate on the Democratic ticket, if the presidential candidate is Joe Biden, will be very important because Joe Biden is in his late 70s. I mean, he's mm-hmm. I think he's about 79, which means he would turn 80 during his term.
Right,
That's getting into a situation where you look at who the vice president is.
Right. You have to remember that Joe Biden ran for president for the first time in 1988. So
yes.
That's 31 years ago that he was running for president. I don't know that we've ever had. I mean, let's say he is the nominee, and I think he's got a good chance.
Yeah.
That would mean that 31 years after he first ran, I don't know that we've ever had anything like that before. I mean,
possible,
I just cannot imagine.
It's possible Harold Stassen, who was once regarded as the perpetual candidate. Harold Stassen had been what they call the boy governor of Minnesota, and I don't remember when he was a boy, but after leaving, he started running for president every time, but I don't know if it was for 31 years.
Right, and he never had a chance to be the nominee of the party, I don't think.
No.
No, it's not like Joe Biden, who does have a legitimate shot at being the presidential nominee. But I would not be surprised, getting back to this meeting between Vice President Biden and this lady, Ms. Abrams from Georgia, I wouldn't be surprised if that's the ticket, because this lady's pretty popular in the party, Bill.
She's very popular. She has no qualifications to be president, and she is from the, quote, progressive wing of the party, which, and you know, if Biden is on the ticket, as the top man, he is going to have to choose one of the people from the progressive wing just to keep them quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he will want to choose someone who they find difficult to criticize. And the progressive wing is the identity politics wing of the party. If you come from a certain group, they're not going to criticize you. And that's
mm-hmm.
That's a sad state of affairs. It really is. That's exactly the opposite of the American ideal. And
right.
But it's going to be one of them. And he, unless one of the presidential candidates who is from that wing is interested in the job, maybe he would choose that person. But it has to be a woman. There's got to be
mm-hmm.
a woman on the ticket, and there has to be a racial minority on the ticket. So, you know, he's probably looking for a twofer. Now, Kamala Harris plays that role, or, you know, fills that role, rather.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if she would be interested in, you know, stepping down from the United States Senate to be vice president. Who knows?
Well, who knows? A lot depends, I suppose, in what she, you know, what the situation is a year from now. Because, I mean, if you think about it, the decision for vice president is not going to be made until the summer of 2020.
That's
so
right.
We're still 18 months away from anybody having to make that call. Well, on the Democrat side, we
and assume. And anything can happen. I mean,
oh,
I remind people that this is 50 lifetimes in politics, and never mm-hmm. to ignore the biological factor. The fact that you're dealing with not even – they don't have to be old. They can be middle-aged. I mean, anybody
mm-hmm.
can suddenly
– sure.
we hope it doesn't happen – die. And the fact of the matter is there is a long tradition of this. Back in 1944, when the Democrats were about to hold their convention and nominate Franklin Roosevelt for a fourth term, the vice president of the United States was Henry Wallace. Henry Wallace
mm-hmm.
was a progressive. He was actually sympathetic to the Soviet Union, and many people in the party felt he should not be nominated with Roosevelt again, because Roosevelt was quite obviously sick to those who saw him. It was never announced publicly. The public never knew it. But people who saw him knew he was at death's door, and they knew that whoever was vice president was going to be president. And that
mm-hmm.
is why Wallace was blocked. Even though he had served through World War II, he had views to the left of the Democratic Party, and they replaced Wallace on the ticket with Harry Truman.
Yeah, interesting. Well, I still think that it's either going to be Vice President Biden or Senator Sanders. I think it's going to be one of those two. And I wouldn't be surprised if it is Senator Sanders, because he's done this before. He's got the energy. He's got the people are really – the people who support him are very strong. They came very close to winning it in 2016, and it looks like the group is back. I mean, I don't think he has any defections as far as I can tell, and he's out there. I think he's going to be a big story, especially if he wins New Hampshire, Bill.
Yes, and he can, because it's a neighboring state to Vermont. People
sure.
know him there. Yes, and it's within the Democratic Party. I mean, as a national candidate, I don't know how well he'll do once people
mm-hmm.
find out what he really believes. I mean, there are
right.
tapes of him praising the Soviet Union, praising
mm-hmm.
Fidel Castro. He's very anti-Israel, and his foreign policy advisors are militantly anti-Israel. At some point, this will come out. And at some point, you know, people forget – the ultimate test is going to be running against Donald Trump. And
mm-hmm.
If he runs against Donald Trump, you then have a question, really, of what the press is going to do. Because, you know, we just assume the press will blindly support Sanders. I'm not so sure that the press will do what it did in Obama's case. Because
mm-hmm.
in Obama's case, you could make some kind of an argument, well, he's left of liberal, but he's really not a
mm-hmm.
socialist. He's just, you know, a very strong liberal. But in this case, you're talking about a man who is an active socialist, basically a Marxist, who honeymooned
mm-hmm.
in the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union is not known as a honeymoon paradise.
No.
I mean,
no.
brides and grooms do not dream of a trip to see Lenin's tomb. They really don't.
No.
I mean, you know.
No.
And this is going to come up. The tapes are going to come up. There are going to be old statements he has made. He has praised, I think I mentioned before, Fidel Castro.
Mm-hmm.
He talked about how beautiful the subways were in Russia. He has, I'm sure, once the opposition research is done, it's going to be a very bad picture, except, of course, for young people who think that's great. It's cool, you know? It's cool.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, I mean, we'll have to see, but I think Bill, I think both Biden and Sanders can really be a problem campaigning because of things they have done or said before, Bill.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, Biden, of course, has a lifetime of gaffes.
Yes.
And he's really untrustworthy on the campaign trail. He also has a long record of being wrong. You know, they talk about his foreign policy experience as being his great gift. His foreign policy experience consists of him being wrong on every major issue. If Joe Biden were president back in the 1980s, we'd still be in the Cold War.
That's right. That's right. He was just he's one of these guys who has not really been on the right side of most of these issues. But apparently, from what they're saying, he connects with some of the people that did not vote for Hillary Clinton. I think
that's
what they
right.
say his best argument is. But, you know, but Trump does the same, too. And, I mean, they're Trump's to lose, as far as I'm concerned. These voters, if they walk away from Trump, well, that's Trump's fault, not really anything else. But I still think it's going to be either Bernie Sanders or Joe Biden. That's just my gut feeling tells me that tonight. But, again, we're 18 months away from anything being real. Well, somebody else – oh, by the way, speaking of Vice President Biden – he almost told us he was running, and then he backed out. Did you know that?
Yes, gaffe number one. That's the first
yes.
gaffe. And he'll probably say during the campaign, you almost go out and vote for Trump.
Oh,
did I say Trump?
Right. Yeah, right, exactly.
The thing is this, that there are two factors that I think have to be mentioned. One is the economy. If the economy holds, I think Trump will be all right. But remember what happened in 2008. Very strangely, 6 weeks before the election, there was an economic collapse. And I still don't feel that was ever sufficiently
right.
explained to us. And there are people on Wall Street, including people like George Soros, who were very hostile to Trump. And there could be some manipulation of the markets right before the election to create an artificial decline. And I think that's something to be watched for. I really do.
No, I've always, you know, it's funny, when that banking crisis happened 30 days before Election Day, I had my doubts, too, about it, because McCain had actually pulled even, and in some polls was actually a few points ahead of Obama, and it seemed to me that they had their first foreign policy debate back in 2008, and McCain looked really good in that debate, and he seemed to be heading into October with a little wind, and then you have this banking crisis that pretty much, I think, cost him the election. Another fellow is in this week, and that's our Beto O'Rourke of El Paso.
Yes.
And, you know, I wasn't sure how he was going to come in, but it doesn't seem to me that he came in very effectively. And more people are asking questions about him. You know, is he just a pretty face? Is this guy,
yes.
does he have the experience? Who is this guy? And there's a lot of questions. Ruben Navarrete wrote a great article about, you know, him, Mitchell, pretending to be a Latino and all of that. But I think, you know, as we were talking off the air, Bill, I think what it really comes down to is that he, you know, look, you have to give him credit. He came within 3 points of beating Senator Cruz, or 3 points back, and that was closer than I thought it was going to be. I'll confess that. But he had everything going for him that year. It was a Democrat turnout year. It was Cruz he was running against, and I would have to think that Cruz was Democrat target number one, Bill, in 2018.
I think he was, and he was somewhat vulnerable because, as we've said, Cruz is not the most likable person in the world. He's brilliant. Everybody knows that. He is a superb expert on the Constitution. But he's not very likable, and people in his own party don't like him. That's always a tremendous liability to people. And Beto comes in from El Paso, claims his name is Beto. It's actually Robert Francis. We don't know quite how he got the name Beto. I think they made something up. But clearly it was designed to make him sound Hispanic, which he is not. And, you know, we've talked about this. Running on a state level is one thing. Running for president is something else. He opened his campaign badly in the sense that he was sitting right next to his wife, you know, the loving wife kind of, you know, right out of the 1950s, and she didn't say anything. And you can't get away with that today. You could 30 years ago, but not today. The second thing is somebody should have sat down and said, look, Beto, the first thing that's going to be asked about you is, who are you? what do you stand for, and why are you qualified to be president? And why don't you make a formal speech about policy? And he would have done much better doing that. But I think because of his experience in Texas, he thought Texas and a senatorial election, election is the entire contest. It's not that. That is on a state level. And you can kind of be a personality on a state level, but on a presidential level, even great personalities like Ronald Reagan had to deal, as he did very well, with policy. There's the old line that was used. Was it Gertrude Stein who described California, saying there's no there. You get the feeling with Beto, there's no there there, that he really is an empty suit, and he did nothing to dispel that belief.
Yeah, well, and it's coming from within his own party. I mean, you have Democrats who are basically asking that question. I just remember the 2018 campaign, and there were times during that campaign when I couldn't believe what I was watching, because he would never give a policy speech. All the speeches were, we have to be together, we have to work together, we don't hate anybody, and you kept expecting him to break into, you know, all you need is love, you know, at any time. And, of course, the Cruz campaign didn't really know how to handle him, because they thought they were going to win easily. And, you know, maybe they underestimated him, as many of us did. But it's so much different when you're running for president. I mean, the questions you're going to get. Now we're finding out that he himself said that one of his liabilities is that he's a white man. I find that incredible. A country like the United States, with a white population of almost 75% of the population, that it would be a liability in one of the two major political parties to be a white man. I mean, I just find that incredible, Bill.
Well, you know, I find it incredible, too, and I find it remarkably insulting for anybody to say something like that. He also said he will understand his white privilege as a white male. I find that insulting also. I wish people would take that kind of stuff out of politics, this endless identity politics, and just run as a candidate. I think it would be refreshing for the American people. But he understands, as we all do, that he's got to get the nomination first. And the Democratic Party is, you know, halfway to the psychiatric institute. The party has gone crazy. It has very dangerous people on its political left. As you know, they recently decided that Fox News would not be permitted to host any of the Republican debates, and even Democrats are saying, what are you so afraid of? I mean, don't you realize how bad this makes you look? But they are now strictly an ideological party. You have to take certain stands or else.
Right. Well, I think it was Bill Maher of HBO who came out criticizing them. Yeah, I thought that was a very stupid decision, but that's what their base wants to hear. I mean, that's what their base wants. And it seems they're just feeding the base whatever the base wants to hear. They're just giving it to them. But I hope somebody on that stage remembers that there's going to be another debate down the road when they've got Trump next to them. And that debate is not going to be as easy. But one man who's warning the Democrats of be careful where you're going is Mayor Emanuel of Chicago. He's the outgoing mayor, I guess. He's warning them against going too far left, though.
I think he is. And you know, here again, we've talked about this. You wonder, in a situation like this, why nobody has come up with a third force. It is exactly made for a third force. If you remember back in 1992, when Ross Perot ran, basically on a platform of a kind of made-up third party, he got 20% of the vote. That is not a small number, but you would think that somebody would come up with the notion, get together with some good people, of a third party, a center-left party, to replace the Democratic Party. Now, I know Howard Schultz of Starbucks wants to run. He's not exactly the most exciting figure. I mean, he could put you to sleep with a cup of coffee. But the fact is that it is a good time for a third-party candidate if that candidate could convince the American people that he was running to win. If he's running just to disrupt the Democratic Party, that you won't get very far with that. But running to win is something else, and I think that a third-party candidate this year would actually have a terrific chance if it were the right candidate.
I think so, and that's why I thought Michael Bloomberg would be that person who was actually
yes.
He's a serious man. We don't always agree with him, but he's a serious guy. And Howard Schultz, I don't know how serious he is. He's been critical of the Democrats. He put together a great business, Starbucks.
Yes.
But I don't know how good of a candidate he would be. But what I think what I would love to see is somebody like he's probably too old right now, but Joe Lieberman. If Joe Lieberman would run as a third party, that would be a serious alternative to either Trump or the Democrats.
You know, it's interesting that Lieberman is, I think, too old.
I think.
And of course, McCain is gone. McCain could have bolted and run as a third-party candidate very easily, and possibly could have won. But there are very, very few people like that left in American life. Generally, the third-party candidate is some prominent person. It could have been a general, a military officer at one time. But we don't have any really prominent generals left who have that kind of name recognition. It's too bad because the leadership bench in America is very, very weak. It really is. I've never seen a time when there are so few people that you would look to and say, "Would you please come forward and lead?"
Right.
when you think of leadership, the kind of leadership that might replace Donald Trump, the name Howard Schultz doesn't come to mind. The name Cory Booker definitely doesn't come to mind. And most of the Democratic candidates. I see, by the way, that we have a new one in the ring this morning.
Yes.
The formal announcement of Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, who is from New York. Now, tomorrow she may say she's from Ohio because she does that kind of thing regularly. And it's interesting that she threw her hat in the ring. Tomorrow she will throw hats of different religions in the ring. And nobody cares that she's in the ring. Here's somebody of who is bright. I mean, she seems to be bright. Obviously, very attractive. She's sometimes known as the hottest senator, and that's a sexist thing to say, but you have to report those things.
Sure.
But the fact of the matter is, nobody particularly likes her, and one of the reasons they don't like her is that she doesn't seem to have any soul. I mean, she's changed her views on so many things, and all you have to do is show her, a poll, and she'll change her views on anything, you know?
Well, speaking of polls, though, Bill, I noticed that she's actually minus in the poll that they took. So her
numbers are
actually minus, which I don't know what that means. But it's less than 1%, I guess that's what it means.
It's probably, or more unfavorable than favorable in that balance. I suspect that's what it means also. But she, she has, again, a fatal defect, and that is she has a trail not only on paper, not only a paper trail, but a videotape trail of her taking positions in the past that are diametrically opposed to her positions today. And she's apologized for those past positions, saying, "I was insensitive. I was insensitive, Chairman Mao, and I did not know your greatness." I mean, if you read Peggy Noonan's column in the Wall Street Journal, and I recommend it, it's online under on her own website, wonderful column comparing what's happening in America now to what happened in communist China, in the period of the of Mao.
The 60s, right?
In the 60s, yes, and the Cultural Revolution, where were denounced, people were killed, people were called on the carpet. Somebody was apparently prosecuted for playing backgammon because it was considered a leisurely activity. And we may be approaching, I don't know if we'd ever get to that point, but certainly in the Democratic Party, we're approaching the point where any disagreement on any issue brings one grief of an extreme nature.
That's right. No, you're right. It's a one party. This is the Democrats are a party that has one track mind, and that's all there is. We're going to take a little break. We'll come back with our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda, right after we hear from some of our sponsors. is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, with our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Bill, if we could just take a little, get off the political track for a quick second and remember Nat King Cole, who was born on this day in 1919, and I have a personal story about him because he recorded a Spanish album in Cuba before Castro, and it was a very popular album of him singing in Spanish. And that was a very popular album for both my mom and my dad. It was one of their favorite albums. And every time I think of Nat King Cole, I think of that album and how happy my mom and dad were always to hear that album of Spanish ballads. And he sounded great in Spanish, but, of course, he sounded perfect in English, Bill.
He did. He was one of our great popular singers at a time when popular music meant something different from what it means today. Today, when they talk of pop, it's kind of pop, songs on a low level. I mean, not great musicianship, not great lyrics, not great music, just kind of pop and hip-hop and stuff like that. But Nat King Cole sang the American standards. He sang them beautifully. He played beautifully. He played standing up. I always thought that was very interesting. And it reminds us of the fact that in that era, we're talking now about the 1940s, 1950s, into the mid-60s, there was African-American culture in just about every middle-class white home in America. We didn't think of it that way. We just thought of them as entertainers or singers or artists. But the number of African-Americans who really did make it to the top, not only in the popular arts but in the classical arts, it's quite astounding when you think of people like Nat Cole, as you just mentioned, when you think of Ella Fitzgerald, Lena Horne, Leontine Price, of course, the classical musicians, including Paul Robeson, who sadly, you know, as an individual went so into politics and embarrassed himself, but he was a great artist. Of course, Marian Anderson, who was barred from singing at Constitutional Hall until Eleanor Roosevelt stepped in, and I think it was either the early 40s or the late 30s, and was extremely well respected. And Duke Ellington, of course, Edward Ellington, known as Duke Ellington. And when you realize that when people thought of African American performers, those are the people they thought of, and they were people on a very, very high musical level. So we shouldn't assume that African-American art and music is simply what we get today, which is a lot of the hip-hop stuff and the Michael Jackson, but on a very sophisticated level. And it's too bad that more people today don't know those names.
Right. Well, and I think a lot of times people think that of the African-American singers would only sing blues and music like that. But, I mean, Nat King Cole was way beyond that. He was a top entertainer. And one of the things that always impresses me about those entertainers, Bill, and maybe you know something about this, is that it seems like now you have one singer who sings one song, and that's his signature song. But back then, I mean, if you go to a Nat King Cole album, he would have many of the same tracks that were on a Frank Sinatra album, were on a Dean Martin album. And it just seems like they all had a certain number of songs they had to sing, Bill. I don't know why, but that's how it was.
Well, there was that item that later became known as the Great American Songbook, and they were the standards. At that time, they were called, and still are, the standards, songs that are in everybody's repertoire. And so you kind of expected every top singer to at some point sing those songs. As you point out, Sinatra and Cole, Dean Martin, you had Billy Eckstein, you had groups, many of which were black groups like the Mills Brothers, the Ink Spots, they all would sing a variety of songs, and as you said, it was amazing how many of them sang the same songs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mills Brothers were absolutely fantastic. I got connected with them in the 70s because they were in a movie or something, and I just listened to their music for the first time, and I really got into them. They're absolutely great. The Ink Spots, sort of a politically incorrect name, I guess, these days.
Oh, yes, but couldn't do that today.
No, you couldn't, but they were absolutely great. But Nat King Cole, 100 years ago today, he died very young. He died in 1965. He was not quite 46. But man, what an entertainer, and what great memory it always brings me of my mom and dad listening to Nat King Cole sing in Spanish. Well, you should try listening to that album, Bill, sometimes. His voice is just fantastic no matter what.
Well,
what
he had that very mellow tenor voice. And
the name King, though? How did that happen? Do you know?
I think it really came from the old fairy tale, Old King Cole. And his name was Nat Cole, and somebody put in the name King, and it stuck, and he became Nat King Cole.
But he's had a trio also, right? A jazz trio, right?
Didn't
he sing with a jazz group as well? I don't know. I don't remember that part, but I thought I saw an album of the Nat King Cole trio. And anyway.
That may have been my memory fails me on that one. But
yeah.
there were
well,
I
let's
mean,
get
if you
back.
Watched if you watched
yeah,
television in the 1950s, even in the age of segregation, many black performers. Ed mm-hmm. Sullivan, of course, featured a lot of them. Many later went on to do movies, but it wasn't unusual at all.
Yeah, no, I think Nat King Cole was just absolutely fantastic. I just think 100 years from now they'll be listening to him. I'm not sure about some of the people who sing today, but they will be listening to Nat King Cole. I have no doubt about that. Well, let's get back to the politics for a second. Anything else on the Democrats that you wanted to touch on before we move to President Trump?
Well, I think we were talking about Rahm Emanuel, the outgoing mayor of Chicago, who has been warning about the party going too far to the left. And I see there's now a new column by Stuart Eisenstadt, who was one of Jimmy Carter's top advisors, and also with the same warning, going too far to the left. I think they're hearing that a lot, but I think that there is the base of the party that has gone completely crazy, and they would rather be left than president. So, they're turning out, first of all, to be the enforcers in the party, and there is a reign of terror in the Democratic Party. You don't make mm-hmm. one mistake. They tell you what you can say and what you cannot say. It is obvious that they favor certain groups over others, which is frightening a lot of people. They are four square behind people like OAC in New York, Alexandria, Ocasio-Cortez, who, by the way, and this is, I think we should point this out.
Yes.
A new Gallup poll came out on her approval in the nation, because now she's been there and made enough noise to be polled, and it turns out that she's not all that popular. I think she's got a 41% disapproval and a 31% approval, and it didn't take her long to become hated.
Well, she's only been, I mean, the amazing thing to me about this young woman from the Bronx or the lady from Minnesota or the lady from Michigan, they've only been officially in 2 months.
Yes.
And look at all the trouble they've already created.
That's right.
For the party, that is.
That's right, and all those things are on tape.
That's it. I mean, the lady in Michigan, she's ready to impeach Trump. She doesn't care what Nancy Pelosi is saying. And the lady in Minnesota, I mean, she's the gift that keeps on giving.
Well,
I mean, she's got something every week.
Well, and she does, and not only that, but she is relentless. And sadly and tragically, she has the support of the Congressional Black Caucus.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, on the part of the Congressional Black Caucus, is a terrible mistake.
Yes.
It just you don't embrace a loose cannon like that. And they're the ones who gave her cover when she made the anti-Semitic remarks. And eventually people start to notice. And it's going to hurt the Congressional Black Caucus. I'm just waiting for the next gaffe. The Democratic Party really does have a large bench of people who don't know what to say. And this is going to be a very, very interesting election campaign. They are going to run entirely against Trump. And they could win, in which case you would probably have a train wreck in the country. But I suspect that if they continue in the direction they are, they will probably lose.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. I mean, I think President Trump has to have the edge at the moment because not so much because of him, but because of them. I mean, the Democrats.
He's lucky
is
in
absolutely,
his opponent.
He sure is. He sure is. Now, this week he had a little trouble with the GOP Senate over that emergency. And, Bill, I mean, I kind of understand what some of these senators are saying, and some of them are men of principle, like Mike Lee, you know, Rand Paul as well. They're men of principle. They believe what they're saying. But I also think you have to counter that with what's happening on the border. And for someone to say there's no emergency on the border, they're either blind or they're just 100% partisan. I don't know how you can have a border where people are coming in every day, where your resources are down to zero because you're using them all, and where you've got people going into hospitals. It's just unsustainable. And for someone to say there's no emergency, I have a real problem with that, Bill.
I do, too. And I think one of the problems we as a country have is that the Democratic left knows that everything it says will be agreed to by a good part of the American press, the echo chamber in the press. And that is not what the press was set up to be. You know, they tell us that they are our watchdogs. They may be watchdogs, but if the burglar comes in the door, they're the first ones to lick his face. You know, I mean, they only watch over some people. They only watch over Republicans. They don't watch over Democrats. And so, some of these people on the fringes feel they will get a very, very good run in today's atmosphere, and they will. And it frightens me.
Yeah, and sadly, too, the news channels have become, I mean, MSNBC is basically an outlet for Democrats.
Yeah.
CNN, they don't get any audience, but they're an outlet for Democrats. And Fox News, I mean, their top two shows are very much pro-Trump. So, I mean, you don't really have a place to go to sort of sit back and get a sense of what's going on where two sides can debate something.
That's right.
So that's why I tend not to watch it, Bill. I just, you know, I'll catch some of the podcasts when they're available on the internet. But I just cannot sit there and watch the whole thing. I mean, it just after a while, you're saying, okay, you say, Hannity, I know you love President Trump. I like President Trump too, but let's have a different, you know, a different discussion. I mean, I don't know. It just bothers me that everything is either pro-Trump or anti-Trump, Bill.
Well, that's it, and that's it's become about Trump. And there's very little policy discussion and very little news reporting.
It.
Very
that's
little
it.
News reporting. You don't get any sense of the background of an individual or of a news story, because all they want to do is express their opinions about Trump. And I think it's going to be an absolutely fascinating time from now until election 2020, but it can also be a very dangerous time.
Well, it sure can, because the country is very, very polarized. But, you know, sometimes President Trump does contribute to some of this.
Yes,
and I'll give you an example. I'll give you an example today. Look, Senator McCain, I know he didn't like President Trump. I get that. But he's been dead for 6 months or whatever. Wouldn't it be better just to leave that alone?
Yes,
of course. I know that Senator McCain, apparently somebody close to Senator McCain was behind that dossier or whatever it was. And, okay, fine. So that's what happened. I wouldn't have criticized Senator McCain. I wouldn't. I would just leave it there. Leave it there. Just move on. Do something else. Talk about something else, Bill.
I think that's absolutely correct. I mean, the president is extremely thin-skinned. He really is. And
he's
petty. Now, to a degree, he's reflecting, in one respect, the personality of Harry Truman. You know, they used to say about Harry Truman, he does the biggest things in the biggest ways and the littlest things in the littlest ways. And to a degree, that's Donald Trump. He can be very petty and mean-spirited. It hurts him. It really doesn't hurt his target. And as you said, I prefer that he stop doing it.
Mm-hmm. Well, some of it I understand why he does it, but others, I mean, the bit over John McCain, I wouldn't get into that. I also wouldn't get into fights with news people. I just, it doesn't make any sense.
Well, there is an old saying, don't get into an argument with people who buy ink by the barrel. And there is a certain logic to it. But I can understand also the other side. He gets so angry because they have been so unfair to him.
Yes,
and I guess
that's
there's
true.
A natural tendency to fight back.
And a little bit of that would have helped George W. Bush in the last couple of years of his presidency, where
yes.
I think he was given, you know, he didn't fight back. So I can understand where President Trump is coming from. But I also think that, you know, when he gets into fights with members of the media, look, I think he's made Jim Acosta famous, because I don't think
yes.
Jim Acosta on his own, nobody would know who he is other than the people mm-hmm. who watch CNN, Bill.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct. And I don't know if he's made him famous in a positive way, though. Acosta is
okay.
so personally obnoxious that
yes,
he
is.
You know,
yeah.
he is what was the phrase that was used by Winston Churchill about John Foster Dulles? He is a bull who brings his own china shop with him.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, something like that Winston Churchill said. Yeah, something like that. I don't remember the exact words, but something like that, yes. But I wouldn't, personally, I wouldn't pay any attention to him, but, you know, that's just me. I think you got to go for the bigger fish to fry.
Well, absolutely,
yeah.
And the president has
yeah.
to maintain, especially in the age of television. You know, Truman can get away with a little bit of that because it was the age of radio. There was a little bit of television toward the end of his administration. And he had that feisty personality, but he also was a man who made great decisions, and he made great decisions involving war or peace.
Mm-hmm.
Trump is not quite in that situation. He is a wealthy businessman, and he's taken on too many targets. You know,
that's
if
true.
You occasionally go off on somebody, that's one thing. But every day, and it's often a member of his own party.
Yes, he does that too much. I'll grant you that. He needs to have like about five or six targets that he hits all the time, and the others leave it to Pence, leave it to other
that's
people
right.
to take care of, or don't
well,
even pay attention to them. I honestly don't
true.
Think getting into a fight with Don Lemon is going to do him any good, Bill.
No, but he watches the news, and that's his tendency. And there should be somebody who's there to stop him. I don't think Melania is that person. I don't think she's that kind of a person who would interfere. But he should have a kind of alter ego in the White House, as Kennedy had with Ted Sorensen, who will say, look, you know, look, Don, this is not what we do, and it's going to hurt you more than it's going to help you. Because he does listen to advice. He, I think, has, in the years that he's been president, become a more sophisticated man. I think that the number of incidents involving him becoming rogue are fewer than they were, but they are still there. And, you know, as you go into an election year, you want to get rid of all your problems.
That's it. That's exactly right. Now, he had this emergency vote. He's going to veto this. But what really bothers me is that the Democrats are unwilling to do anything other than investigate. And I mentioned that in New York, they're investigating President Trump again over his foundation, I guess. And it's like, come on, let go of this stuff. Let the guy be president. And if there's something about the foundation, well, you can do it after he leaves office. But right now, this is not fair for a president to have to defend himself about something that happened in New York before he was president, assuming that it happened at all, Bill.
That's right. And I think that the sense of unfairness exists in the country, the feeling that the president is being treated unfairly. That will help him in the campaign, and it will also diminish the role of the press, because the press has become so outlandish and so obvious in its bigotry. But in the interim, it's hurting the country. You know, the press says, well, the press will say, well, we are the watchdogs. We are the watchdogs. Well, first of all, who's watching the watchdogs? But when they say watchdogs, my question to them is, what were you when Obama was in office? A poodle? I mean, they never watched over him at all. They never criticized him at all. They are the watchdogs, basically, at least the great number of journalists, the majority of journalists, are watchdogs over the Republicans, but not over the Democrats. And that,
yeah, they've gone from
the
one extreme.
Pick that up.
Yeah, I think they've gone from one extreme to the other when it comes to coverage of President Obama. They were so easy, and now they're just absolutely obnoxious how far they go with President Trump. What do you think of Jeb Bush saying that somebody should challenge President Trump in 2020? I don't get that. I mean, if he wants to do it, he should do it, I guess.
That's right.
But don't say
and
somebody should do it. Why doesn't he do it then?
Look, I understand his resentment. I mean, it's
oh,
very
I agree.
Real. His father was president, his brother was president. He wanted to be president, and he did a very fine job as governor of Florida. He really
Excellent.
Did. I think he was highly respected, and he felt he was much more qualified. And I agree with you. If he wanted to challenge Trump, he should have challenged Trump. I don't think he would have gotten that far. Trump may not be popular in his party, but one thing that he does have is he does have the party's back when it comes to fighting back. I mean,
mm-hmm.
the people in the Republican Party who make up the majority know that at least they have a fighter in the White House. And people have appreciated that. You hear this all the time. You know, I don't really like him. I don't like his cursing. I don't like his vulgar behavior. But my God, the man fights. It's like the comment made by Lincoln about U.S. Grant when he was told that Grant was a drunkard. And he said, well, whatever he drinks, send him a case of it. You know, sometimes you overlook some certain defects.
Yes. And that is, you're right. That is one quality that I like a great deal about President Trump, because as much as I supported and liked the second President Bush, I wish he had had a little bit more of that in his second term, because I think they said lies about him that were, I mean, Katrina and the Iraq War, a lot of things they were saying that he decided not to fight back. And I think it hurt him, Bill.
I think that's absolutely correct. And I think one of the problems, ironically, that Bush had was that Bush was too much of a gentleman. And it's
mm-hmm.
interesting also that if you look at what is being said about Trump, very few things said about Trump weren't also said about George W. Bush. People
no,
forget
absolutely.
he was called illegitimate.
Mm-hmm.
He was called stupid. He was called unprepared. And people have forgotten that the terminology that was used against him. I remember Bush 41 complaining, especially about the New York Times and the way it was treating his son, and he was absolutely right.
You know, they were saying that if Beto was a Republican, they would call him George W. Bush, because they actually do have very similar backgrounds. They had a famous father.
Yes.
They went to prep schools or private schools. They had what some would call a privileged life, although I'm not exactly sure what that means, but that's what they call it.
Yes.
And they say they would call him George W. Bush if he was a Republican, somebody with that kind of a background.
Look, the hypocrisy in the press just flows onward and onward and onward. I mean, they one standard is applied to one person, another standard is applied to another person. And, of course, the past master of that is CNN. I mean, CNN, calling itself the first name in news, well, you know, do you laugh now or do you cry? It may be
right.
The first name in views, but it's not the first name in news, because there's very little news on the country, on the network that calls itself the first name in news.
Right. They may have been the first news channel, but that's where it stops.
Ted Turner's Big Risk. They started in the early 80s. The thing was always tilted to the left from the beginning, but during the Trump era, it has gone completely off the cliff.
I used to, you know, they weren't really, I mean, they were always, you're right, they tilted left. But I remember they used to have this call called Crossfire.
Yes.
And Larry King was on. And Larry King had a lot of different guests on his show. I think they're crazy now. They were tolerable maybe 20 or 25 years ago. But under Trump, they've become unwatchable as far as I'm, you know, I cannot watch it. I have no idea what the number is on my TV station for CNN. If I had to find it, I wouldn't even know the number. I would have to sit there and click the remote.
I don't blame you, because it's like watching the same story over and over. I mean,
right.
How many anti-Trump stories can you take?
Right. How
and,
many panels can you have?
Oh, and the panels are completely unmemorable. Do you remember, can you recall any comment made by any of those people? In any discussion, you'd think occasionally somebody would come up with a linguistic gem, you know, a
right.
saying worth repeating. They're just these kind of dull, predictable panels. They don't inform us about anything. And very frankly, I think if CNN were to disappear tomorrow, there would be no loss to American journalism.
No. Nobody would miss it, except the people at the airports would have a blank screen. But they would have to put a different channel on there, I guess. Bill, looking at next week, anything in particular you'll keep an eye on next week?
Well, there are actually quite a few things happening. First of all, the development of the American presidential campaign,
mm-hmm.
which will now be with us. Second is the standing, and I think the poll on our friend Little Evita from the Bronx was very telling in how unpopular she is nationally. I will bet they now start doing more polling like that of the outspoken mm-hmm. Democrats, and the Democrats, I think, will turn up very disappointed in the result. There is the investigation into the Boeing crashes, mm-hmm. very important. Boeing is a very important American company, and obviously
yes.
the lives of the people come first. That is the most important. But there are some things that have been hinted at that are disturbing in the way we perhaps prepare that plane. I'll be following that. I'll be looking for any new presidential prospects in the Democratic Party, because pretty soon the whole party will be running.
That's right.
And also, a very interesting developing story about our relationship with North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
They issued a statement today that was very, very tough, but other diplomats saying, don't worry about it, you know, they're just posturing. But they have now threatened to get out of the negotiations and to go back to missile tests. And that is something that would put the president in a very, very awkward position. But my hope is that they will come to their senses and realize that negotiating with the United States is a net plus for them.
Right. There's also talk of a China trade deal, too.
Yes.
We'll wonder when that's going to happen. But they say that's getting closer and closer. And, of course, we don't know what's going to happen in Venezuela. That could pop at any moment. That's pretty ugly down there. That is just...
It is, and we should note also that the progressive wing of the Democratic Party refuses to condemn Maduro.
Right.
Absolutely refuses. That's like the progressives and the of the 1940s and 50s refusing to condemn the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing, and that's what Sanders will run into if he gets the nomination. People will look back on him. But it is
amazing that
these people, including Little Evita from New York, will not condemn the Maduro administration.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think they're so out of touch with reality when they make statements like that. I mean, it's one thing to call for a Green Deal, but it's quite another not to call out Maduro, who is obviously illegitimate and a dictator. I mean,
yes.
I don't know why they wouldn't do that with Maduro. Well, Bill, as always, thank you for your time. Have a great week. Look forward to Urgent Agenda during the week, and keep up the great work, and happy St. Patrick's Day. Maybe you still have a chance to go out and have a parade today, Bill.
I will try to find a green tie.
Yes, do that.
And I will say it stands for my support for the Green Deal.
Yes, yes. I'm surprised nobody came up with that line today.
Yes.
All right. Bill, thank you as always.
Have a good week, Sylvia. We'll talk again next Sunday.
We'll do it again next Sunday. Our good friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda, always have a fun time talking with Bill and reviewing many of the things that happened during the week. Democrats, President Trump, lots of things going on around the world, and we always get an opportunity to talk about it with our friend Bill Katz. Good night, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.